Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
The war in Iraq for the first time since the invasion today, as the Pentagon notes a new death toll in the war. The number of U.S. servicemen and women killed since 2003 has now hit 2,500. Also today, Iraqi government officials released purported al-Qaeda documents, including a terrorist plan to get out of the crisis in Iraq by sparking war between the U.S. and Iran. U.S. officials say the documents were found in a safe house used by terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi before he was killed in a U.S. airstrike on another safe house last week. Well, joining us with the latest from Baghdad is Los Angeles Times correspondent Borzu Daragahi. And Borzu, let's start with these documents. Iraqi officials say they are a huge treasure, but do you think they're real?
Well, according to the U.S. military, they were found on a computer well before the Zarqawi incident in a safe house used by the Zarqawi network. And it happened well before the incident last week in which U.S. planes dropped two 500-pound bombs on a house northeast of Aqaba and killed Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. You know, there are some real questions, though, about the authenticity of these documents. It was interesting that it was the gentleman, Muwaffaq Rabai, who's a very intelligent a physician, actually, who's become a player in the Iraqi political arena, chose today to release them because, he's basically been effectively kind of cut out of the elite of the security apparatus to some extent. And, this is a way of maybe bolstering his profile, but I don't know. I mean, just reading through some of this stuff that's in here, it's just, it doesn't jive with reality.
Well, we've got a copy here that's on the Associated Press, and we'll post it on our website. Essentially, it reads like what Iraqi government leadership might hope that the terrorists are feeling. For instance, it conveys, allegedly in the terrorist voice, a feeling that there's a crisis and that they're losing ground because the National Guard has been so well trained by American forces. And so they've got to undertake new tactics to get out of the crisis, to get out of the bleak situation.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of interesting things here, saying that their media, that the Iraqi government's media campaign is successful in depicting us as bad guys, and we have to spruce up our image. I mean, I don't know. It struck me that these militants are not really that interested in sprucing up their image. If they were, they wouldn't be beheading people on television.
It also says that U.S. forces, by undertaking massive arrest operations, invading regions that have an impact on the terrorists' resistance, have caused the resistance to lose many of its elements. This may be true, but does this seem like something al-Qaeda would admit to in a memo?
Well, I also think that, to some extent, it's not true, because I think, and even U.S. military officials now recognize and acknowledge that these sort of mass arrests, these acts of collective punishment are to be avoided at all costs, because if anything, these are the tools that create new recruits for an organization like al-Qaeda. I just don't see it. I think that the insurgents love it, especially the al-Qaeda insurgents. They love it when the U.S. Does something like, take huge draconian action against a Sunni Arab city, because it builds up support for them.
Well, and let's just touch on one other element again. In these papers alleged to have been written by al-Qaeda in Iraq and found in a safe house, they talk about sparking war between the U.S. and Iran to take the spotlight off of what, is what they call a weakening insurgency. What do you make of that idea, whether it was written by terrorists or an Iraqi official?
I mean, I just don't know. I mean, freeing the Sunni people in Iran, drowning the Americans in another war that will engage many of their forces. It's just, a lot of it didn't ring true.
Well, let's turn to Baghdad and the situation there where you are. Day two of a security crackdown, and that includes more checkpoints. We were hearing from reporters yesterday that many felt that made them less safe because checkpoints made them targets. Greater security presence on the streets, with 49,000 Iraqi soldiers and police and 7,200 coalition forces being deployed. What is the feeling on the streets of Baghdad? Does it feel more safe?
It's been quiet. There's been periods of quiet in Iraq before. I'm not sure about those numbers. I would be very cautious about the new numbers of soldiers being deployed or numbers of security forces being deployed in Baghdad. I don't think there's been any increase in numbers. according to the officials that I talked to. One thing that we've been noticing is that they've been removing a lot of soldiers from western Baghdad, which is a stronghold of the Sunni Arab insurgency, and spreading them out to other parts of the capital. On the other hand, the cops that I saw today and yesterday, they seem pretty relaxed, you know, sitting in the shade, you know, watching the traffic go by. If that's their idea of a security crackdown, it's not that, draconian of a security crackdown.
Well, this comes, Borzu, as Congress here in the States debates the war in Iraq and a possible end time for the war. And Iraq's national security advisor says that many U.S. troops will leave Iraq by the end of the year, and in fact anticipates the last foreign soldier will leave Iraq perhaps by mid-2008.
Well, I'll go back to the source of that comment. It was a source who released this document today. You know, there's two ways to get power in Iraq. One is to organize a militia. The other way is to just get on TV a lot and make a lot of headlines and make yourself sort of a figure using the media. I don't think that Muafak Rabai, who's a nice guy, is in the loop as to decisions on when or how U.S. troops will be leaving Iraq. I think that at this point, the general Iraqi attitude on the streets is not very hopeful about the country's circumstances. It's 44 degrees centigrade. I don't know how that translates into Fahrenheit. It's, you know, well over 100 degrees, and there's maybe a couple hours of electricity every day. So I think that's what concerns Iraqi people here. Most Iraqi people that I know that are educated are just trying to get out.
Borzu Daragahi, Los Angeles Times correspondent, speaking to us from Baghdad. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's my pleasure.
And now to Congress and the politics of the war in Iraq. As one congressman said this morning, lawmakers are fighting the war on the battlefield of American public opinion. Well, they're arguably coming at it a bit late. Today, members of both the House and Senate are engaging in their first substantive debate on the war in Iraq since troops invaded 3 years ago. In the House, lawmakers are sparring over a Republican amendment aimed at painting the Democrats into a corner. It calls for supporting the troops and completing the mission in Iraq, and it rejects setting an arbitrary date for troop withdrawal. Well, that last part is tricky for Democrats. They're divided on the issue of troop withdrawal, and today they seem united against the debate itself. Democrat after Democrat took to the floor to condemn it. Here's New York Democrat Louise Slaughter.
A day not about policy or progress, but about politics and posturing. It's a day designed to provide the majority with a chance to make cheap political attacks against Democrats in anticipation of upcoming midterm elections.
Well, joining us now on the line from Capitol Hill is Rick Klein, who covers Congress for the Boston Globe. And, Rick, that comment was made, you know, before formal debate, but it's confusing because wasn't the whole idea of a debate in the House originally a Democratic proposal?
Yeah, Democrats for quite some time have said, let's have a full and fair open debate over this war. There hasn't been one since the original vote to authorize force in October of 2002, and certainly not since the invasion or any of the aftermath. But what Republicans decided to do here was really to own the issue on their own terms. They scheduled it for just a week after the killing of Zarqawi, the terrorist leader, and obviously right after President Bush returns from Baghdad. And the resolution that they are putting forward, and they're not allowing any amendments to it, any Democratic alternatives to it, anything like that, links Iraq to the broader war on terror and really puts Democrats in a tough spot. Are you for or against the United States anti-terror efforts? It's really not a debate over Iraq.
And for or against the troops, do we understand?
Well, I think that's how it'll be portrayed. What Democrats are saying is, look, we have helped Republicans pass all of the bills that the president's asked for to pay for the troops in combat, and in some cases want to be more generous than the Bush administration or the Republican Congress. But that certainly is one of the Republican talking points today as this debate unfolds, is you're disrespecting the troops by not supporting their mission.
Mm. Well, where does the debate on troop withdrawal stand in the Senate? We understand John Kerry has an amendment for troops that would allow troops to be pulled out by the end of the year in 6 months. By the way, something we thought this amendment lawmakers once said had no chance of passage but was just, again, to spark discussion. But this week, the Democrats seemed to take it very seriously. As we know, Hillary Clinton was booed by a very liberal group of Democrats when she spoke out against that hard, fast date on troop withdrawal. So what is this amendment? Is it real?
The Kerry Amendment is real. It does not have a chance of passing, if that's the question.
Right.
He and Senator Russ Feingold will be among a pretty small group, I would guess, somewhere in the around a dozen Democratic members may end up supporting it. but no more than that, I wouldn't think. What Democrats are trying to do, though, is find more of a consensus for their own party. And what they're talking about is something that they're calling phased redeployment or strategic redeployment. Basically, it calls for the president to begin withdrawing troops quickly, although I don't think it would set a time frame, and certainly not a time frame for total withdrawal, and it makes clear something that's actually in Senator Kerry's plan as well, that you'd keep what they're calling an over-the-horizon force elsewhere in the region that could act quickly and move into Iraq or elsewhere to respond to an emergency.
Okay. Well, we're going to be speaking to some pollsters in just a second, but what's the perception, you know, by Democrats? Was this a mistake on the part of John Kerry, if in fact it's known within the party that there's such a division on this issue?
Well, there's a split, as there is on the war in general. I think for members who feel like the war was a terrible mistake, as Nancy Pelosi is calling it a grotesque mistake, they say, why not put Democrats on record as opposing this war and wanting to bring an end to it? For those who were strong supporters of the mission in Iraq, Senate, like Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, they say, yeah, this is the wrong debate at the wrong time. We're sending a bad message to the troops. And for a lot of members who are in between, they may be uncomfortable with the particulars of Senator Kerry's argument, but do believe that the Congress should send some sort of a message regarding the war and expressing some disapproval over the conduct and how it's been moving forward.
Rick Klein, Washington correspondent for the Boston Globe. Rick, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, now we want to turn to two men actively involved in helping politicians shape their stances and perhaps even their comments today. Pollster Doug Usher is vice president of the Melman Group. He's worked for Democratic candidates, including Massachusetts Senator John Kerry in the 2004 presidential campaign. Doug, welcome.
Thank you.
And Republican pollster Whit Ayers with Ayers, McHenry & Associates in Washington, D.C. Whit, as always, we welcome you.
Robin, good to be with you.
And we just got a couple minutes. We're going to keep you on after the break. But, Whit, let's start with you. Americans seem to be debating, at least in the polls, what do we do now in Iraq? Do you think this debate in Congress today is useful?
Well, I think it doesn't make sense for our elected officials not to be debating one of the critical questions facing the country right now, which is what we do in Iraq and when we do it. So, sure, I think it makes a lot of sense to have an open debate on the question.
But do you think it's, as we heard a Democratic lawmaker say, do you think it's just posturing on the part of Republicans to put forward something in the House, at least, that forces the Democrats to, you know, either be for or against the troops? When is that really the question that the American people want put forth?
Well, the question the American people are wrestling with right now is, what do we do in Iraq? How long do the troops stay? Do they come home immediately? Do they come home after some set period of time? Or do they stay perhaps indefinitely to finish the mission? So that's really the question Americans are wrestling with right now, and it's perfectly reasonable to have our elected officials wrestling with the same question.
And Doug Usher, I just have a few seconds to have you have a thought here that we'll take a break to think about and then come back to you. What should Democrats do today?
A couple of things. I agree with Whit that the American people are tackling very much some of the issues that we're talking about in the House, but I think it's important that Democrats talk about the full range of issues that are out there, not just a closed-ended resolution that's frankly a political trick. But I do think the one thing that brings Americans and the Democratic Party together is anger and upset at the way the Bush administration has handled this war.
That's the last word from Doug Usher, but he'll be right back. Doug and Whit Ayers, both pollsters, Republican and Democrat. We'll come back with them in just a minute. More ahead here and now. First substantive debate in Congress on the war in Iraq since that war began 3 years ago. At issue today is whether to set a date for withdrawing troops, and Democrats in both the House and the Senate are divided on that issue. In the House, lawmakers are sparring over a Republican resolution which calls for supporting the troops but avoids setting a date for withdrawal. And while Democrats are furious, as we've been hearing, at not being able to amend that resolution in any way, even some Republicans are nervous about it. Republican Congressman from Illinois, Ray LaHood, called it a dumb idea that will call attention to how war-weary Americans are and might spell trouble for the GOP in midterm elections come November. Well, and now we turn to two men actively involved in those elections. Whit Ayers is with Ayers, McHenry & Associates in Washington, D.C., a Republican pollster, and Doug Usher, vice president of the Melman Group, a Democratic handler. And, Doug, you were just saying before the break that you think Americans are angry at the Republicans and at President Bush for getting us into this, getting the U.S. into this war in the first first place. But, you know, are Americans also perhaps angry at the Democratic Party for not seeming to have a cohesive message or even stance on the war?
You know, I don't think that their anger at all is focused on the Democratic Party. I think right now, even in the post-Zarqawi world, what you're seeing are poll numbers that continue to be bad for Bush, not just overall, but also in the handling of the war. And the question for today, unfortunately, becomes a closed-ended question, which is a political trick on the House floor by Republicans. I do think that Americans do want a full debate, one that looks at how we've handled the situation so far, how we've gotten to where we are today, but more importantly, how we're going to move forward. And, you know, there's definitely some division within the Democratic ranks about whether to set a specific timetable, and Democrats are fully aware of that. But that debate also is going on in the American public generally. And the question isn't really about setting specific timetables. It's about how we end this war as quickly as possible, how we bring troops home. And anybody who says that they don't want to end the war as quickly as possible and don't want to bring troops home as quickly as possible, I think are misreading public opinion polling.
Well, Whitehurst, first of all, your response to that.
Well, I think Doug is right. All Americans want to end the war as quickly as possible. The question is under what terms? And the terms create some real difficulties for the Democrats. The problem is that the phrase cut and run really does accurately describe what the liberal wing of the Democratic Party wants to do. Not all Democrats, certainly, but the wing of the Democratic Party that booed Hillary Clinton this past week.
Well, yeah, that's the problem there, though, isn't it, Whit? Because Hillary Clinton is one of the very strong Democrats who is of the we broke it, we have to fix it school. We need to stay and fix it.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of scary for a Republican when Hillary Clinton is the voice of reason, but in this case she is. And the problem for Democrats is that more than 8 out of 10 Americans reject the proposal to withdraw troops immediately, regardless of the circumstances. And that really does paint the Democrats in a corner, because the vocal activist wing of the party, a very substantial part of the party, really does want to do something that 8 out of 10 Americans reject. And that's a problem.
Well, I want to ask you, just for one second, Doug, if you don't mind, just to continue with Whit. You mentioned the phrase cut and run. We were hearing the word retreat, the phrase cut and run. Are these the talking points for Republicans, you know, to paint any move by the Democrats to bring troops home as retreat? And do you think, I mean, they're pejoratives. And do you think the American people will see that as politics?
Well, I think American people see most of what goes on in Washington as politics, but I think that the phrase accurately describes what at least some liberal Democrats want to do. They're embarrassed that we're there in the first place. They think we made a mistake to go there in the first place, and they basically want to withdraw the troops regardless of what happens to Iraq and regardless of the 2,500 Americans who lost their lives there.
Doug Usher.
And most Americans don't believe that.
I'm going to get Doug Usher to jump in. Your thoughts?
Well, a couple things. I mean, first, nobody cares more deeply or cares as deeply as Democrats do about the 2,500 soldiers that we've lost in Iraq. And Whit is right in saying that there are a few people that want to withdraw troops immediately, both in the American public and, frankly, within any Democrats who have any say in this debate. But I think what's most important to note here as we move forward is that Democrats want to find a solution to this crisis and, most importantly, bring our troops home as well. And I frankly think that there's a lot of agreement between Democrats and Republicans on this. I think where there's disagreement is that a lot of Republicans are walking lockstep with George W. Bush in his handling of the war and saying that everything that he's done has been fine up to this point. No wrong decisions have been made. Everything has gone perfectly well. I think the American people see right through that.
Well, Whitehurst, what about that? What about Republicans like we mentioned Congressman LaHood, who have been home and visited with their constituents? And, you know, this idea, as he said, a dumb idea of forcing people to sign a resolution saying they support the troops. Do you think that's going to backfire on Republicans in 5 months at the midterm election when Americans are being told you don't support the troops if you're thinking about, you know, when they should come home?
Well, I don't think anybody really believes that, and I don't think President Bush believes there have been no mistakes in Iraq, and certainly most Republicans don't believe that. Well, the real question, and it's a critical question, is under what conditions should our troops come home? And if we're not going to squander those 2,500 American lives, and if we are not going to leave Iraq to the terrorists, then that suggests that certain conditions ought to preclude coming home rather than a fixed date on the calendar. That's where the debate is right now, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate debate to have, and reasonable people will disagree.
But, absolutely, and I guess one thing I would add is, you know, the flip side of some of the questions that the Republican leadership are framing right now is, do we expect to be in Iraq for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? And then the other question is, how many more troops are we willing to lose in Iraq? I think that Democrats right now are battling with that issue because the American people are. I think that the Republicans, unfortunately, are saying we need to set these benchmarks that don't mean anything, and many of which are unrealistic, sadly. I think there are very few, as I said before, meaningful Democrats who want to pull out troops immediately. That is, as of today. And having said that, I think there is a decent debate going on with the Democratic Party, which is reflective of what's going on in the American public, about how quickly we can not cut and run, as Republicans would say, but frankly get the job done as quickly as possible.
That's Doug Usher, Vice President of the Mellman Group. He's worked for Democratic candidates. Also been speaking with Whit Ayers of Ayers, McHenry & Associates in Washington, D.C. He works with the Republicans, and we're working with them hard today. Thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
News on the economy out this week, and it's all contradictory. Output at the nation's mines, factories, and utilities fell unexpectedly last month. That's a change from the sizzling 5.3% growth rate of the U.S. economy in the first part of the year. The number of unemployment claims fell as well, which could be good news, except that the economy created only 75,000 new jobs last month, when experts had hoped for 175,000. And a moderate rise in inflation reported yesterday has stirred up some immoderate fears among economists and investors. Well, to try to make sense of it all, we turn to Mike Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek, author of Rational Exuberance. Mike, welcome.
Oh, glad to be here.
And what do you think? I mean, just give us a quick umbrella in English, please, because it's so hard to decipher this. What do you think these numbers mean?
Well, the first thing to remember is that what you've all cited is a lot of numbers about the domestic U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
And what's really different about today is that we live in a global economy, so that what's happening in China or what's happening in Europe is just as important as what's happening in the U.S. So part of the reason why everything seems so contradictory is we're only looking at a small piece.
So you're saying a number here could be offset by another number there, which will ultimately impact us.
Exactly. Think about, for example, the number that you cited on manufacturing. Well, frankly, what's more important today is what's happening in manufacturing in China. Mm-hmm. Than what's happened. A lot of our manufacturing has moved over there.
Mm-hmm.
So the manufacturing numbers that you cited don't matter quite as much as they used to. The same thing is true on, say, the unemployment claims. What we have in today's economy is relatively low unemployment, but we don't have very much job creation. And a lot of the reasons why is because of high productivity growth, and also because we live in a global economy where companies are expanding overseas.
I was going to say, refer back to the manufacturing number in another country.
That's right.
And some people, we always like to point out, you know, some people say when there's a low number of unemployment claims, it could be that some people have given up. You know, they can't find anything.
That's not really what's happening right now. What's happening right now is that not too many people are being fired, but not too many people are being hired either. The other thing right now that's very confusing is that when you look at the inflation numbers is that the inflation number has accelerated a little bit, but it's still really pretty low compared to what it was in the past.
Well, hold up a second there. And, you know, as you well know, some people think that a low number can run wild if it's not nipped in the bud. But let's just take a second to remind ourselves about this word, inflation. Let me try it. People spend a lot, so supplies start to run out, so prices go up because there's less supply. But then people stop buying because prices have gone up, and then there's too much product available, so businesses slash prices. Am I sort of close?
Oh, I don't know. What inflation really is that prices go up, and so that And so that workers demand higher wages, and then prices go up some more. And before you know it, everybody's all confused because prices are going up a lot, and nobody can figure out whether they're going hither or yon.
Well, they, okay. that's just as good.
So, that's just as good.
So you're saying that prices are going up a little bit?
Well, what I'm saying is that the numbers are showing a slight acceleration at the rate at which prices are going up. But, you know, on the one hand, you've got people who sort of say, well, prices are really not going up. They're being held down by overseas competition. They're being held by productivity gains. This is mismeasurement. Other people are saying, no, really, the things are bigger. And once again, what we're just seeing is a small slice of the pie. Some people say, well, let's worry about inflation in China. That could be just as important. We are stuck in between. Our economic statistics, the things that we look at, are still mostly focused in the U.S., mm-hmm. but we live in a global world. We live in a knowledge economy, but really what we've got is manufacturing statistics.
Well, but see, when you say that we have to look at the bigger pie, a lot of people are saying, yes, but I still have to feed my family the pie. And, you know, the average person's experience, we've just been talking around, is that inflation is seeming to hit them more. It feels like prices, especially food and home prices have, well, not home as much. Home, we know we're starting to see drop. But food prices, you know, the things you buy, those prices seem to have gone up.
Well, actually, what I think is really true for a lot of people is that the rate of price increases has exceeded the rate of wage increases. So people's real buying power has gone down. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, that's not only real, but that's verifiable in the statistics. Sort of having said that, you say, well, what are we going to do with this? Is this good news or bad news? Well, it's good news. It's bad news, obviously, if you are trying to make ends meet through your wages. On the other hand, if you own a home, and your home is now worth $100,000 more than it was 3 or 4 years ago, or maybe your mortgage payments have gone down, are you better or worse off?
Well, we are finding home prices dropping because it's a buyer's market, and that brings us to interest rates.
That brings us to interest rates, which
I just want to ask you about. You know, if in fact it seems like you're saying that inflation isn't as big a problem as, the front page of the New York Times portrayed it today.
Oh, that was not a good story.
It did portray it as a potential problem, inflation that could run wild,
yeah.
But people have the perception because we're hearing, well, central banks are raising interest rates, the thought is to slow down what is perceived as a cycle of, you know, rising prices.
What central banks are really doing is that after the 2000-2001 crash and the fears of deflation, they all moved to very low interest rates and very easy monetary policy. The Bank of Japan especially, you don't think we would get away without another global reference. The Bank of Japan went to zero interest rates. Hmm. Really what central banks are doing now is they're moving back towards normalcy, away from having really low interest rates. And we've grown used to low interest rates, of course. But it's not so much that they're terribly scared of inflation. What they're scared of is pumping too much money into the economy for too long. You know, all this talk about, I really have to say that the focus on inflation at this point, in a world where there's this massive flood of goods from overseas, there's this massive worry about competition from overseas, we're not seeing any real wage increases. This is not an inflationary economy that we're in. It's an economy where there's a lot of things going on that we don't understand, which is confusing, a lot of global things, a lot of technologies, but it's not an inflationary economy.
Well, I'm happy to hear an economist say that it's confusing. I thought it was just me.
Well, if you're honest and you know about the economy, you have to say that things have changed, and it's pretty clear. The two things that have changed, one is that it's a global economy, and the other is that it's a knowledge economy. You know, you're on the radio right now. The radio sector, for example, which is a part of the knowledge economy, very, very poorly tracked in the numbers. Have you ever seen a radio index?
No.
No, you haven't seen a radio index. You haven't seen an index on any of the things which are important these days on the knowledge side. We still mostly track the old manufacturing industry. So things are confused and confusing in part because the statistics and the economists are mostly backwards looking.
Well, we're going to have you back, Mike, but I'm encouraged by the final thought here, which is it's confusing. Mike Mandel, chief economist at Business Week, the author of Rational Exuberance. Mike, thanks so much.
Next time I'll unconfuse you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. And now, a challenge for you. Two Harvard psychiatrists say they will give you a check for $1,000 if you can find an incidence of the medical condition known as repressed memory in literature, opera, or even historical records before the year 1800. The two psychiatrists are critics of the theory of repressed memories, the theory developed by Freud in the mid-1800s, that buried memories exist and have to be ferreted out by therapists. Dr. Harrison Pope of McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, is one of the researchers involved in the project. He joins us now on the line. Welcome, Doctor.
Hello.
Why 1800? Why do these examples have to be from before 1800?
Well, let me set the stage. Natural human psychological phenomena, things like anxiety, delusions, hallucinations, have been portrayed in written works, fictional and non-fictional, all over the world throughout the ages. And we had noticed, to our surprise, that so-called repressed memory, the ability to have amnesia for a traumatic event, did not seem to appear in any written work that we had seen prior to about the mid-1800s.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided, in effect, to put our money where our mouth is and to see if anyone in the world could find a case that had occurred prior to the Victorian era.
So what are you saying, that those references after, you know, the mid-1800s perhaps, are influenced by the thinking of the time? In other words, people heard about it, you know, it was talked about, and so they began writing about it?
Yes, that there was a shift in thinking to a different view of the human mind, I believe, that started to occur in the mid-19th century. The absence of cases before 1800 suggests that repressed memory is not a natural human psychological phenomenon, but rather that it's a cultural artifact, if you will, that it is a belief that is peculiar to recent times and to our culture, rather than being something that is based on a bona fide neurological or brain process.
So you're not saying that it doesn't happen. You're saying that if it does happen, it's because people are influenced to make it happen somehow?
Precisely. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen. What I'm saying is the evidence suggests that repressed memory is what would be called a pseudo-neurological symptom. It's real in the sense that people really do walk into doctors' offices and describe it, you know, in all honesty, but that it is not based on an actual process that is happening in the brain.
Well, now, as you well know, you have your critics. One of them, Ross Chait, I believe is how you pronounce it, a political scientist at Brown, who runs his own website, which, by the way, we'll have all this information on our website for listeners later. But he says, you know, this is just a stunt. And besides, how can you expect people before 1800 to talk about something that they didn't really have the language for? It would be like looking for examples of characters talking about a round world before it was discovered that the world was round.
Well, this is one of the many counterarguments that we consider in our paper. And the point is that if an otherwise lucid individual had a traumatic event, like seeing their family get killed, and then developed complete amnesia for that trauma afterwards, that is such a graphic phenomenon that it would be recognizable in someone's description, even if that description had been written 1,000 years ago in another language, even if it had been interpreted by some earlier writer as a supernatural event or described in very different psychological terms. The fact of developing complete amnesia for a trauma would be unmistakable, even if you saw it through a dense veil of cultural interpretation.
Well, now listen, I'm sure people are going to take up your challenge, and we're going to tell listeners how to do that. In the meantime, you're getting tons of, you know, samples sent to you, and you've discarded most of them for various reasons. Let's just bring up one. One researcher online had this example from the 4th century epic poem, The Fall of Troy, when the Greek king Menelaus tells his wife Helen, "No more remember past griefs, seal them up, hid in thine heart, let all be locked within the dim, dark mansion of forgetfulness." It sounds as if he's recommending repressed memory to her.
Well, what's happening is that Menelaus, the past griefs to which Menelaus is referring is, of course, the fact that Helen was abducted to Troy. And Menelaus is saying that it would be very nice if she could try to forget that. But there is nothing in Quintus Smyrnaeus' poem to suggest that Helen actually was able to suggest that.
Okay, I can just, I feel the challenge is on. Dr. Harrison Pope of McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, one of two psychiatrists who says he will give you a $1,000 check if you can find an incident of repressed memory before the year 1800. To find out how to do that, go to our website, here-now.org. Dr. Pope, we accept the challenge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Trend was one of many American soldiers in Iraq who kept an online journal of what he saw. Thousands were able to read along and experience what he experienced. The difference between Jonathan and other bloggers, he wrote about birds. Jonathan was a member of the Connecticut National Guard stationed on a base which was attacked almost daily with mortars and rockets, but he would still go birding. Portions of his online journal, Birding Babylon, have now been compiled in a book, Birding Babylon, A Soldier's Journey from Iraq. And he joins us from station WMPR in Hartford, Connecticut, with more. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And some of us have heard you when you were in Iraq. You did some interviews, you know, from there. Back home, about the birds that you saw. You write that you'd been a birder since the age of 12. And I'm wondering, as you headed for Iraq, you know, when did it occur to you that you'd bird there?
As soon as I found out I was going, I got a hold of the appropriate field guide and started studying up. So it was high on my priority list. Not getting shot was probably one of my top priorities.
Yeah. Well, and what did you see? I mean, when you looked around, what did you see?
Well, I was surprised at all the water birds that I saw, kingfishers and ducks, egrets. It was kind of interesting to see a lot of the same birds that I could see here in Connecticut also. Mm-hmm. So there were the exotic birds and also the familiar.
Right. Some of the exotic, I'm looking here, the common babbler, one of the Iraqi birds that people liked, the white-cheeked bulbuls. What are they?
They're kind of a small songbird, kind of brown with a black head and a big white cheek. They're very active, and even when it's 120 degrees, they're flying around singing, carrying on.
I understand you used binoculars while in Iraq. And I have this wonderful image of, you know, all the troops pointing in one direction with their binoculars, and there's Jonathan pointing in the other direction with his binoculars because you've sighted a bird.
That sometimes happened.
Yeah. And you wonder what people might have thought of you. What did people think of you walking around with your binoculars looking up in trees and such?
Some people probably were wondering what was stuck up in the tree. But the people who knew me knew, this is Sergeant Truon Trent's thing, looking for birds, catching bugs, and catching lizards.
It sounds as if, it's a terrible way to say it, but it's a wonderful way to spend a war, because it got you out. It got you really connecting with people and place.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, I'm not unique in doing that. There's many letters and journals from World War I, the Civil War, even in Vietnam, people stopped and noticed kind of the wildlife. Mm-hmm. And since I've been back, I've been in touch with quite a few, both military and civilians, who went over and kind of packed the binoculars with them.
Mm-hmm. Why? We've done a lot on birding. We happen to have a soft spot for birding here on the program. But why is that important? I mean, why would, explain it to someone, why your heart would lift so when you would see a babbler or a crested lark? What is it about it?
Well, I think it's life. Kind of there in the midst of a lot of destruction, there's something positive, something that's timeless. These birds have been going back and forth through the area since the dawn of history. So it's kind of something you can hold on to instead of, the kind of temporary disruption and violence.
Well, in fact, there were moments when the temporary and the long time collided. I'm thinking of, it's on page 17, when you'd gone out on a convoy And you're telling us there about the crested larks. Can you tell us a little bit about that bird? And then if you wouldn't mind reading that paragraph on page 17 of when you came across it some.
Sure. The crested larks, they kind of have a little top knot. I guess you could call them the Don King of the bird world in Iraq.
And they tend to run around a lot. And at this point, you notice some. Why don't you read for us?
Sure. Our convoy up from Kuwait had to stop because one of the Humvees had a flat. We all piled out of the vehicle and set up a defensive perimeter with our weapons pointing out. It was a bit of a surreal scene. I'm lying on the ground with my eye on some guy racing around in a pickup truck, wonder if he's going to take a pot shot at us, which would have been suicidal. While a pair of crested larks were not even 10 feet from me, the male displaying and dancing around.
That's one of the few times in the book it seems as if you go out of your way not to make some sort of elaborate metaphor, you know, for the birds that you're looking at. But there seems to be something there about how you're just noticing, I don't know, there's something wacky about human behavior, and maybe the birds are onto it.
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few stories from World War I that I think kind of illustrate that. In fact, even in the poem Flanders Fields, they talk about how after the artillery stopped in the midst of battle, the birds would just start singing. So they're just kind of waiting around for people to stop their nonsense for a little while, yeah. And so they could get back to business.
You got to go to some terrific places and, you know, see how ecologically these places are doing since you were paying attention. We know that after the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein caused huge damage, draining the marshes in southern Iraq in retaliation against the marsh Arabs there. Have the lands come back? Have the birds come back?
Yeah, actually, I've talked to a few Iraqis lately, and the UN actually has a monitoring program for the marshes. They take satellite imagery every week. When the war kicked off in March of 2003, they believe only 7% of the original marshes remained. The latest figure I saw was they were at 58%. And the birds, they've seen some birds that they thought had gone extinct or were about to. There's a little songbird, a warbler, that's really only found in that area.
Jonathan, birders keep life lists of, you know, a compilation of all the birds that they've seen every time you see one for the first time. And you had some, you know, first-time lifers, right, in Iraq?
Yeah.
Can you tell us one that just really made your heart sore?
I'll tell you two. One was the hoopoe. It's kind of a mythical bird almost. It's mentioned in the Quran, and it's just a very unusual-looking bird with a huge crest that it can put up and down. It's kind of salmon-colored with very striking black and white wings. And, you know, since I've been a child, I've seen pictures of it. So seeing one was very cool. And the second was a tern, white-winged tern, or actually, sorry, whiskered tern. I had actually gone twice to Delaware from Connecticut to look for the first North American record of this bird and expended quite a bit of energy and didn't see it. I saw one of those on our base, and they ended up being a very common bird. So it was very nice to see that, too.
Jonathan, I know you want to go back, but what would draw you back, the birds or the mission?
Either. I was very supportive of our mission there, and I really enjoy going out to the villages, doing medical missions out to the villages surrounding our base. And I liked interacting with my Iraqi friends who would come on our base every day.
Jonathan Truin-Trend, his Iraq birding blog, has been turned into a book, a beautiful little book called Birding Babylon, A Soldier's Journal from Iraq. Jonathan, thanks so much.
No problem.
To read Jonathan's blog, go to our website, here-now.org. Special thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for our bird sounds, including this hoopoe. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these